Welcome to this conversation, and that's what it's basically going to be. What you read in your program is the program we're going to try to follow as best we can. Today's world calls all believers to embrace diversity at many levels: geographical, ethnic, social, economic, theological, etc. Ministering in such a world is a tremendous challenge. Lawrence Rogers, to my right, lives and ministers in such a context in Baltimore. Billy Curl, to my left, has ministered for many years and is now retired as pulpit minister, but still is ministering in the heart of Los Angeles. And I think, as the program says, these men's insights will be invaluable to us. Lawrence Rogers is a minister of the Westside Church of Christ in Baltimore, Maryland. He is in the Master of Divinity program at Howard University School of Divinity and is a graduate, undergraduate of Harding. And he has some very interesting perspectives, I think, that he will be sharing with us. Billy is a 1964 graduate. We made it off across the stage in the same year here at ACU. And has done mission work in Ethiopia as well as ministering it for about 40 years or so in the heart of Los Angeles. And he currently is still serving as a trustee, and he was a trustee for a number of years at ACU during my presidency. And we have been friends for a long time. So I think this will really be a great conversation. I'm going to do my best to stop about 2:05. You'll be thinking about comments, particularly questions you'd like to have of these men, and we'll try to work in as many as we can. This is a recording device, and unfortunately it has to stay there. So you can see these guys, and that's they're the main attraction. Lawrence, I want to start with you. The theme for this week is love God, love your neighbor, first and second greatest commandment. And that's all well and good, but how do you do it on the ground? How do you make something like that operational, specifically in your congregation?
Okay, I just want to say hello to everybody. I'm so grateful for your time this afternoon. Love your neighbor as yourself, and love God. I think one thing that's very important for every person to ask themselves is, what ways do I feel that I'm better than someone else? So if you say, I don't have anything that I feel that I'm better than someone else, you probably have a lot more than what you know. I think that we must ask ourselves, in what ways am I better than someone else? Because if you can answer that question, you can find who you are blind to. There are many people in our society that we are totally invisible to. And oftentimes in our churches, people who we are visible to in society are also invisible to us in the church, or people come in and feel underserved and don't feel like they are involved. And so I have to deal with the question of who am I, who do I feel I'm better than? This question is so important. If we study Jesus' ministry from this type of point of view, I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
We'll see that Jesus is dealing with people on the edge. Jesus is dealing with people who gather on the edge. The lepers were on the edge. They were on the edge. Sinners were on the edge. The woman at the well, the Samaritan woman, she was on the edge. Jesus is going to people who are invisible, and Jesus is saying that I see you. He's saying, I see you, and I affirm your humanity. So if I'm going to love my neighbor, I have to see my neighbor. I guarantee that many of us drive past people every Sunday in church who are invisible. And we may just walk past certain people and don't hug them who aren't visible to us. And it's not always about race. It can be about economics. It can be about gender, whatever. But if I'm going to be real about this Jesus walk, I have to deal with who do I feel like I'm better than? And how can I make sure that I see people who are around me? Because no other time will I be able to truly embrace diversity if people are invisible.
So the invisible people have to be identified, in other words.
identify and affirm, and we have to map their assets.
Requires a bit of honesty, doesn't it?
It does.
Reality check.
It does.
Hello, everybody. It's really good to hear my brother talk about diversity. From a different perspective, I grew up, as a matter of fact, I'm a native of East Texas. Anybody ever heard of Nacogdoches, Texas? Oh, good, I have some friends. At least I have some friends. If you're a graduate of, or if you ever play Stephen F. Austin, I did a speech at a basketball game that was in Los Angeles from ACU, and asked me to talk to the students, to the athletes. And I basically said one thing, and I regretted it later. I said, you know, I don't really care who you lose to as long as you beat Stephen F. Austin. So I could see a puzzled look on their faces, and I knew that they didn't understand what I meant by that. It is that when I graduated from high school, I was not allowed to go and to be a student at Stephen F. Austin. That impacted my life in that I could just go right up the street to this university. I could be a student at this university, and I was not allowed to because of the color of my skin. And that made such a devastating effect that even to this day, 50 plus years later, I still remember those kinds of things. It's like overcoming cancer. It's like overcoming something that is that has cut you from the inside out. One of the things that I think the Lord has done is that he has surrounded me with a hedge, and that when Jesus became an integral part of my life, I had to go inside of me to go back and deal with those issues that I grew up with. And it made such a radical transformation in my life, in that I had to look at other people as just being people all over. Everybody invisible or everybody visible. It's either one or the other. And it is still a job. It is still a process. I'm still working through that, because I could relapse at any moment, you know, and I could go back and think of the injustices that my father had to go through, that we all had to go through, especially when there was legal segregation, not just implied, not just economic, not just political, but legal. Where I could be beaten by a policeman and everybody could stand around and laugh. And knowing that there was absolutely nothing could be done about that. To where I would go to a church of Christ and told that I couldn't come in. That type of impact on my life still rings true when it pops up every now and then.
I'm assuming you resonate with what Billy is saying, although the two of you are of a different generation. And both ends of the continent, I think that's kind of cool too. We kind of covered our large metropolitan areas. But I'm curious, Lawrence, about digging a little bit deeper into the question I asked you first. What is the makeup of your church? And back to that basic question, how do you make that work?
Yes. Well, we have so many different types of people at the church. Not everybody speaks English at our church. We have non-English speakers. We have black folks, white folks, Spanish folks, Asian folks, people from the islands, all kind of folks. And we are folks together. We're good folks. So, that's the makeup of our church.
And that's not easy. I mean, I'm rolling a little bit here.
No, it's not. It's not easy. And I think that's the reason why a lot of people do not like real diversity. There's this thing we talked about many years that we should have a place where all cultures can come, be multicultural, right? And when we use this term multicultural, what we were really saying was people will come in with their different cultures and all be in the same church together with different cultures. Now, I really don't think I believe in multiculturalism anymore. I think that one church is going to have one culture. So if I take a Petri dish, that dish, any science folks in there? That dish is one culture, right? One culture in a Petri dish. The church is going to have one culture. Now, the problem is, what kind of culture, the question is, rather, what kind of culture does the church want to have? This really solves a lot of issues with white culture clashing against black culture or Asian culture or Hispanic culture or whatever. It solves a lot of issues this, when you say what kind of culture you want to have. What I argue for is detach your culture, detach your church culture from your racial identity. At Westside, we have a culture of justice. Justice, J-U-S-T-I-C-E, not J-U-S-T-U-S. Right, sometimes we want what's justice for us, but not what's just for someone across the street. So we have a culture of justice, and when we all gather together around justice, what is just, what is righteous, we find that it reduces the struggles between people trying to represent for their racial culture. Another problem I want to say to this audience is white people have to recognize that they have a culture. Because one of the things is that a lot of white folks think their culture is normative. And when we say diversity, we say everybody else adapt white culture, right? And what you do is you cause people who have different backgrounds to do violence to themselves, to let go of parts of themselves that are really meant to bless you and bless your community. We are blessed by every group of people that comes into the church and who they are. We are blessed by it. It doesn't hurt us. Now, if we wanted to have a dominant culture that's based upon racial identity, then it would hurt us. And we'll say, oh, we're losing this. But because our culture is geared towards what is just, we can all get together and celebrate one another's culture. We can celebrate one another's racial identities, right? But it begins with me recognizing it. You have to recognize it, right? Some of you may have played Bob Dylan at your family cookout, or McGraw, maybe played Tim McGraw or Billy Ray Cyrus. And at the other folks' cookout, they were playing Earth, Wind, and Fire and the OJs. Celebrate that. I like Bob Dylan. I like Jim Croce. I enjoy it. You know, I like the country music, some of it that I've been introduced to. Getting to know different kinds of people. Learn the Electric Slide. Celebrate these things. You know, celebrate it. It's not your enemy. But I think that a lot of churches have a really weak view of diversity. What they ask for is assimilation. They don't say, let's have diversity. They say, you assimilate into who we are. So let's celebrate what you bring to us.
Let me ask you, follow up on that, a little more detail. Looking back in the history of your congregation, do you identify some crisis points where maybe it could have gone either way, or there was some challenge to the kind of evenness, the kind of equity that you're talking about?
Yes, well, one of the elders from my church is here. Alan Decker is here in the front here. He's been there for 50 years. And we talk a lot about the history that the church has had. The church wasn't always a diverse church. It was mostly white church for its history. And as the area began to become more diverse, the church began to become more diverse. And so the church grew in diversity, and the church did have challenges. You know, it's not easy. It's a mess. I mean, diversity is a mess. You know, it's a mess. You know, but you know what else is a mess? Salad. It is. And for a long time we talked about the pot that melts, this melting pot, you know? But who wants to eat a melting pot?
Doesn't melt.
Yeah, it doesn't melt, and everything becomes the same, and it's boring. But a salad bowl, you got everything together in a bowl, and you put salad dressing on it, and it's a mess. And you get salad dressing all the way in your face, and lettuce in between your teeth, and you bite the little, the juice squirts out and everything in your face. It's a mess, but it's a delicious mess, right? So we can learn to embrace the mess and be patient. But what's important is for people with hearts like you who are willing to come to this class,
when you're in these congregations, to stand up for what is right. The reason why people are left out or ignored or overlooked is because people who know better don't say anything about it. You know, and I'm so grateful I was invited to this. I'm so grateful. I'm happy. I'm invited. I'm happy. So don't think I'm not happy with what I'm about to say. All right? But I look through the program here for Summit, and I see a lot of white folks. And that's good. You know, I love white folks too. But then I see a class on diversity, and we have two black men speaking on diversity. I really want to start seeing black people at ACU Summit speaking about Howard Thurman or, you know, grace and love and mercy. Not always just racism and everything. I want to see white folks talking about racism. That's what I want. I want to train up white people and encourage them to discuss racism and diversity. Because the truth of the matter is, no matter how eloquent I am, there are some audiences that are not going to listen to me because of what I look like. But they will listen to you. And so we need people who are courageous enough to go into these spaces and tell people the truth and stop being silent when bad things happen, you know.
Billy, you've got a little bit different model, church model.
Yes.
Mars, talk about the history of your
party. It's very interesting. The Crenshaw Church is in a middle class neighborhood in Los Angeles. But when I went there, it was an amazing that this church had two white elders, two black elders, two white deacons, two black deacons, and a white preacher. Most of the members of this church is made up of Pepperdine people, professors and teachers and administrators. And the preacher happens to be a white man who was a chancellor. He was a provost of Pepperdine University on the Los Angeles campus. The interesting thing that happened that when Pepperdine moved from the inner city of Los Angeles out to Malibu, it was like a 747 jet taking off. It went from here to there. And our church went from 160 people, 80% of them white, to 5% white. And everybody just left and moved. Not everybody was a part of Pepperdine. Some of them were there because they just liked the area. So we went from 160 people to 40 people in a matter of 24 hours and just walked away. Just so happens that one of the elders happened to be a part of Pepperdine, moved, and left three elders, two black elders, two one white elder. The white guy just said, I don't care what y'all say, I'm not moving. I live in the neighborhood, I'm retired, I work for the post office, I'm gonna stay here. That created a whole set, a different set of problems and issues that we had to face. One is, are we going to stay here? How are we going to function? We can't pay our bills. He just said, well, let's start praying and have the Lord to determine whether this is a good ministry or not. And the members got involved saying, oh, maybe we need to go get another white preacher. I went as the black preacher. What are we going to do? And we discussed that for a month. And then all of a sudden, okay, enough discussion. We're going to take over from here. We're going to just go to the neighborhood. We're going to see what's in the neighborhood. And we grew from 45 to 50 people to over 600. And now we have a diversity. But it's interesting. If you were to walk into our building, you would see very few white people. But you would come in contact with people from everywhere in the world. They just happen to be black. They speak Spanish. They speak German. They speak all different languages. But they look just like us. And they worship just like us. And we have Hispanic families. We have people who are from Costa Rica. Dark-skinned people, but they are not American. They are not native-born Americans. And assimilated very well. And our method of evangelism had to be, we are one in Christ. And that church just took off and just really grew. Some of the challenges that we had is that during the 70s, when we had the riots, a lot of people came. We had an upsurge of gang activity. People came to us and said, what are you all going to do? And it was the elder that was white who stood up and said, you can discuss anything you want to in this church. You want to talk about diversity, you want to talk about how bad white people are, how bad black people are. You can talk about that, but I want you to know you can talk about it, but we don't have that problem here. And that just settled everybody down. And we got together, we created a safe haven for anybody who wanted to get away from some of those street thugs. We were, when the riots came, and they started burning all around us, we stood there and they said, don't bother that church. That's a safe haven. So anybody that came to our building was safe from anywhere else. And it was an unknown thing throughout the community. So if you came to our church now, you would see a diversity of people. And they just love each other. And Jesus taught that principle of love. That when you love somebody, you forget about where they came from, what their economic background is. So we have in our church people who are on welfare, people who are very wealthy. The welfare people give more money in church, of course. And y'all gonna get that on your way home. We have people who are highly educated, from their PhDs, from doctors to illiterate. We run the gamut of whatever is in our community and that exists there. And it creates and brings more problems. But it's working.
I'd like to ask both of you, in terms of the actual work of the church, both of you have talked a little bit about evangelism, about what you do. Could you go a little bit further in terms of responding to the surroundings about you? How does a church like this spend its money? What are areas of emphasis? You catch what I'm saying?
Yeah.
I think that tells a story too.
Yeah, we have a lot of ministries. We have one where we work with people who don't have any homes. We go out and it's a multifold ministry. We work with homeless people in our ministries. We work with homeless families that come to us. We have put several homeless families into homes and helped them to transition from homelessness to having a home and a job and everything like this. But we also go and work with politicians and to help to advocate for better policies for the homeless people in the city, in Baltimore City and County. We also work with people who, there is a human trafficking problem across the country. It's bad here in Texas, it's also bad in Maryland, it's bad in Baltimore. We have a human trafficking ministry that we take very, very seriously, the issue of human trafficking. There's a lot of people being sex trafficked, people who are not free, and their bodies are being sold. And we have a human trafficking ministry where we use the same model that we do for the homeless ministry. Also, there's a literacy ministry at Westside that we use to help people to learn how to read. There was a study that came out that said that the prisons are being built using data from children's third grade literacy scores. So based upon how well a child can read in the third grade, they base this on how many prisons to build. So we said, how can we interrupt this school-to-prison pipeline? Because if you don't aware of this, you can Google it when you go home. We said, we can interrupt this. So what was one thing we can do is help to promote literacy. But we also advocate against mass incarceration and advocate for reentry citizens. So I'm going to be down in D.C. In a couple of weeks advocating and working with other people to fight mass incarceration in this country and for prisons that are making money off of basically free labor from those who are in prison, and states are signing contracts that are guaranteeing a certain rate of prisoners in these prisons. And so I don't see how society can progress when we have this kind of situation going on. And so we have a reentry citizens program So when I talk about a culture of justice, we are all working together for issues that relate to us. One person might feel they're called to the human trafficking industry, so people of different racial groups, economic backgrounds, they're all working together on that. Another person feels called to the homeless ministry, and they're working on that. Another person feels called to work on reentry citizens. And we have other ministries, I just named a few of them, but it's twofold for us. We want to do something to alleviate the current condition, and unfortunately that's when many churches stop. But we also need to advocate and have relationships with our city council, our local politicians, activists on the ground, in order to work to fix the problems within the system itself. There are problems within the system that help to create some of these issues and to maintain them and sustain them. And so we need to fight against that and try to correct those problems.
The thing that occurs to me as you're talking about that, in the predominantly white churches, there is an arm's length distance with systemic issues. Hmm. And I think that's probably because a predominantly white church is in a predominantly power position, and you don't really have to in the sense of urgency that you might do in other contexts.
I definitely see where you're coming from, but I mean, our church, there is a large middle class demographic, and you know they live comfortable lives, and they probably don't have to either. But you know, someone has to encourage them and to call them to it, even when it's uncomfortable. And so, you know, we have to push one of those. We have to stretch that up to good works. And what we have to do is see the humanity in everybody. I don't care how low you think a person is. That person is just as much a human as you are. And that's what the disciples realized in John 4. Once again, Chris, my apologies. Is that, you know, when they, Chris asked me to say the Jesus stuff for tomorrow when this class comes. So you know about that. But in John 4, you know, the text says the disciples knew not to question Jesus. They already knew what kind of guy Jesus was. So when they saw Jesus with a Samaritan woman who was an outsider, and she was a woman, which means she was an outsider, and she was at the well in the middle of the day, which also means she was probably looked down upon, and she had all these miracle issues, we looked down upon, Jesus still said, I see you, I see your humanity. And when the disciples came and they wanted to ask questions about it and look down on her and frown upon her, the text says they knew better than to ask Jesus questions. That's what kind of religious leaders we ought to be. And that's kind of what we ought to be. And if we are the kind of people, I think many of our churches will follow. You know, that was funny. One last thing I want to say. Some churches you go to, you can notice that the men there will sometimes dress like the minister. If the minister's a good leader, the men will sometimes have the same dress and the same hairstyle. They will. Why? When I travel from church to church, I notice this. You know, a lot of the men will dress and have the same hairstyle as the leader does. So if they're willing to dress and design their hair like the religious leader, why wouldn't they follow us to serve our communities?
I have let's get it interesting here. You've touched on this, Lawrence, but I ask both of you, what irritates you the most about sessions like this or discussion of topics like this? You could take that approach, or maybe what, on a more positive side, what more would you like to see happen? Why isn't something happening?
The first part of that is, what irritates me the most? Repetition. I do this all over the country, and I don't see any change. That's one of the things. Nothing seems to happen. Maybe it is, and I don't see it. But it's more like I got an education. I was able to go to this session, and I heard this man talk about this. That's a good thing that he said. Then I go back to my enclave, and I live a beautiful life, and everything goes well in my life. One of the things that if I may, it's interesting. In the black church, it basically, the direction the preacher goes is the way the congregation goes. And one of the things that I did after I left ACU is that I became a missionary in Africa. And I did a speech in Tigard, Oregon. And
that's Tigard.
Tigard?
Not Tigard. Tigard.
Tigard. Thank you. I forgot. And one of the things somebody asked me, why do you want to go to Africa? And I said, well, when I was in the 12th grade in high school, I had a desire to go to Africa. Why? Because I wanted to see if Tarzan was really alive. And that was my introduction to Africa, was what I saw on television. And television actually said Tarzan was running through the trees and he was talking to all the animals and he got all of them to do that type of thing. Well, when I came back and I became the preacher of the church, we established 300 churches in Ethiopia. And this little small church where I used to preach now supports full-time 42 preachers. We have an elementary school that has 800 students that we support full-time. And people are amazed. You all do this? What type of budget do you have? Where do you get the money from? Do you call some of the larger churches, i.e. white churches, to help you? No, we do it ourselves. And we don't publicize it. We just do it. And it is absolutely amazing that people are surprised at what we do. And I'm not surprised. And the thing that happens, that really happens, is that you go where the interest of the ministry is. And I've been a missionary, so I've always wanted to do that. And so people migrate to us from China, from the Philippines, from India. And all the time we're having some type of a program for a mission project. And so now that we have a new minister, the emphasis is changing a little bit. He wants to develop men. He wants to develop the young men. He's really interested in marriage. Because marriages are falling apart. He really wants to do that type of thing in the church there.
That's great. That's a great answer, Mark.
If you invite me to come speak on diversity and racism, I'll do it, you know. But I really like to talk about theology a lot, and I like to talk about Jesus studies and biblical studies. This is what I love to do. But I will come talk about racism and diversity as much as you like. I just don't know if people take it seriously. I don't know if it's, I'm just like on showcase, and I'm just being put on display. You know, that's something that I think about sometimes. And I also oftentimes wonder how come I never hardly see any white people leading presentations on racism. I just don't understand. You know, I see white people leading presentations on everything else, and then black people getting invited to talk about racism and diversity as if all this is who we are. Like it's all we do is we just talk about racism. Like I mean, we talk about other things, you know.
Both of you know about some of the conferences we've all been to and spoken at. But the interesting thing that I've noticed about that is that. That draws out only people who have a particular interest.
Yes.
And it doesn't lead back into the local Latin local congregation.
Yes.
In fact, it is a hard sell, speaking out of my own background, it's a hard sell to convince a church that they ought to study the biblical view of racism. Mm-hmm. And it's like pushing a rope. It's really tough. And if you put it in an elective situation, you may face an empty room, which is, in my opinion, so convicting. It just underlines the fact of the need even more.
I think there's two situations going on. I think that some people do not want to lose any type of clout they might have with other people. So like they know that they have some type of capital. You know, they have a social capital. So they're like, if I speak out against certain things in my church, I'm gonna lose this.
Okay.
People who follow me, I don't care about social capital. Jesus told me that if I'm willing to, he said, if I lose my life, I'll gain another. I'm willing to lose my life by being another. That has been true my whole life. Social capital has not been an issue for me thus far in life. I just speak what I feel is the truth. The second thing I think is going on is I think that there's some people who do not want to speak out against what they feel benefits them. But many of us are trapped in systems that we know things are happening that's not right, but because we realize we benefited from it somehow, we don't want to deconstruct it. And that's sin. We ought to at least try to deconstruct it. We ought to at least try. Jesus never said that follow me and you'll be able to build great empires for yourself. Jesus said, as Bonhoeffer once said, when Christ calls a person, I'm making it gender inclusive, Christ calls him or her to come and die. That was the promise of Christ, to give up this life. I don't know if we really have embraced Jesus. I think that may be the reason why we struggle with this so much, because we really haven't taken time to understand what Jesus was doing.
It's pretty scary.
It most definitely is. But privilege is a blindness. And everyone has privilege, some sort of privilege, and we somehow blind. That's what I talked about invisibility in the beginning. Privilege blinds us to things. Lord of the Rings, anyone? Privilege turns you into Gollum. That's what happens. You become Gollum. And so privilege is a blindness. And the more we lose privilege, the more we can see. And this is the reason why Western civilization has really shot themselves in the foot by not listening and studying the theology of those at the bottom. Those at the bottom can tell you about the thief on the cross much better than someone at the top, who's never had to know what it's like to be a thief, right? So privilege blinds us in many ways, and we close our ears to certain things, and the way we close our ears makes us sustainers and maintainers of the privilege that we have. And so we don't want to deconstruct it. So we'll come to stuff like this, and we'll leave the same because we realize that we'll lose something. Something. We'll lose something. Maybe our uncle won't talk to us anymore, you know. But we'll lose something if we try to help this cause.
Questions or comments from any of you? Yes, sir.
Yes, you said that you don't see much change. I read something recently. Is that like it's going to take another 200 years for us in America to all get on the same level or whatever. Would you agree that the best thing to do in this situation would be to, if it possible, to move to a diverse neighborhood? Would that be like the best thing a person could do? Or should we just like speak to this, or, you know?
I think in some circumstances that is true. In my older age now, I've gotten a little bit more radical. We fought for integration. Now I don't care about it. It used to be something that I really wanted to demonstrate for. I wanted to be able to integrate everything. Now it doesn't matter to me. I'm a little different from Lawrence in that the people that he loved, the singers that he loved, I don't particularly care for. I like James Brown. That says, just get out of the way and let me open my own door, rather than ask you to open the door for me. That's the right thought.
I don't know, my favorite song.
One of your favorite songs. And now I recognize people as to who they are. If they're white churches, that's fine with me. Next Sunday, I'm going to a white church, and I'm going to have a very difficult time preaching to the church because they're going to look at me and not blink. They're going to just look like me. And now, at the church where I preach, or used to, they would stand up if I said something good. They would throw their hands at me if I said something that they didn't like. One lady don't like me. Every time I get up, she walks out. It's a very viable type of a thing. So you're right. Go home with me. Hang out with my kids. go to church with me. After lunch, go have lunch with me. Come and hang out in my community. You'll be surprised at how our communities are and how viable our communities are, and also our churches.
Okay. If I don't live in your community, how do I do that? How do I insert myself into your community if I don't live there?
If you don't visit.
You mean just go visit?
Yes, and stay. You don't have to move in. Just come and hang out. Because I come to your community and hang out. Because if I come to your community and hang out, the food at the grocery store is cheaper.
Yeah. And gas and all that.
If you don't mind, if I can just comment. Maybe when I get older, I feel more like but right now, I look at my three-year-old daughter, and I ask myself, what kind of world am I going to pass down to her? I think about Dr. King, who said, if we don't learn to live together and make it gender inclusive as brothers and sisters, we're going to perish together as fools. I think the wind of this age is proving that to be true. I think that we are on the horizon of something very disastrous, and I feel that if those of us who can work together do not work together, there will be much pain in gnashing your teeth. And I don't want to pass that kind of world down to my daughter. I don't know if integration is the answer. I don't know if mutual separation is the answer. But for right now, I think one thing that is good, I know, is that when we come together and we're in close proximity to one another, it demystifies me. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was in boot camp for the Air Force, a young man from somewhere told me that I was the first black person he ever met. He said, I was surprised by the way you talk. I was surprised that you don't like the sagger fatigues. I was surprised you don't curse in every other word. Pretty much he told me what he saw in Cops every night. That's what he thought I was. Him being in close proximity to me, he was able to learn more about black folks. Right? Proximity is beneficial. I would hate for us to lose that. It helps us to humanize one another.
People come to Los Angeles, and the first thing you want to go is, where is Boys in the Hood shot? I want to see the movie. I want to go to the wall where they hang all of these murals. Why don't you come over and have lunch with me and just hang out? And I grew up during Martin Luther King Jr.'s era. I was told that I couldn't march with him. I feel really hurt deep down inside that I didn't get that opportunity to do that. A friend of mine, a classmate of mine, did. He snuck off and went, got beat up in Tennessee with baseball bats. He's in insane asylum right now. He will never be sane again because of what he did. And one of the freedom riders and those types of things. I can't go to those museums and see those buses because I lived during that time, and that it hits me deep inside. I can't look at it as if it's just a museum that I go visit. I go visit me.
That's right.
In that.
Well, we've tried integration. You come to us, but what if we haven't tried integration, but we come to y'all?
You'd have a good time.
Yeah, I've got a question over here somewhere. Yes,
Tom. I go to and work at a church that is very, very undiverse, and I'm still waking up to the need for that personally. I mean, I see it much more now than I used to. I'm having a hard time convincing the people in our church that diversity is a desirable trait for our church. So do you have any, because most of them would deny that things like racism are still an issue, because I think the blindness of privilege. Do you have any suggestions or ways that we can speak to our church in a way that says, here is why diversity would be good for us as a church, here is how we can accomplish the mission of the kingdom of God.
About 2 minutes left.
That was the mission of Jesus. Just take the gospel to everybody. If we start living in our own enclaves, then we're denying really the love of Jesus to everybody.
Yeah. Yes.
Of one the Lord has made the race, through one has come the fall. Where sin has gone, must go his grace. The gospel is for all. You're probably too young to have ever sung that. Some of us older folks will remember that. That there is only one race. Pigmentation is a fact of our lives, but there is only one race. We're all sons of Adam, all sons of Eve. Little children, let us love in word, not love in word or talk, but in deed and in truth. And if we can begin to express that, yes. And John chapter 4, the woman at the well, the first time Jesus ever expressed himself as Messiah was to that woman. And that's significant. The first day, go away me, hello, my son.
Let me end by making a couple of statements. We've got to expect time because of another class coming in here. What if, we'll chase this tomorrow, what if our source of identity was from being in Christ? In Christ. Those of us who have confessed Christ, that's one thing we all share. Rather than going to the racial or the ethnic or the gender or the condition, the pathology, the, you name it, the label, we are in a labeling society. What if we dropped all the labels and just came back to just being in Christ, which goes back to the hymn our brother just quoted for us. I think it's a great thing. Now, just to entice you back tomorrow, if you come again tomorrow, we just may talk about the influence of the media and the influence of politics on our situation. Again, we may not. It depends on how courageous I become in the next 23 hours.